You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up at 6 on 1A+, does America have a free speech problem? Jen White and her guests look at where the debate stands over shaming, shunning, and the right to speak freely. Plus, hear 1A's new series, In Case You Missed It. That's today at 6. But next, players from Stanford, South Carolina, Louisville, and UConn, women's college basketball teams, are arriving in Minneapolis today after securing their spots as the final four squads competing in the NCAA National Championship this weekend. While the term March Madness has long been associated with the men's college tournament, this is the first time the women have also been able to use this well-known branding. It's fitting, given this year is the 50th anniversary of Title IX, the law that, at least by design, sought to remove sex-based obstacles to being able to learn and work as we choose. And we'd love to hear from you. What does Title IX mean to you? Do you think we have made progress in this area? Do you remember what it was like before? 1-800-642-1234. Email us ideas@wpr.org. To reflect on this moment in history, we're joined by Mary Jo Kane. She's professor emerita at the School of Kinesiology, the University of Minnesota. She's also the director emerita of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport. Mary Jo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Molly. I am delighted to be here on what I know will be a very exciting week in the Twin Cities.
Yeah, so tell us what the mood is like there in Minneapolis.
Well, it's been pretty crazy. We're quite proud. You know, it's a very competitive bid to try to get the Final Four at all. And the fact that we found out that we not only got the Final Four, but that the University of Minnesota would be hosting the Final Four in the 50th anniversary of Title IX, it's been pretty crazy. And then I'm assuming many of your listeners last night, and maybe you did too, Molly, watched the double overtime thriller between UConn and the University of UNC, North Carolina State. And I bring that up only because the clutch player of the game was Paige Beckers, who is from Hopkins, Minnesota. So hometown girl makes good and comes back. And I can assure you that ESPN, who is carrying the Final Four, couldn't be more thrilled to have great matchups with great superstars and great programs and coaches. I mean, you couldn't have a better lineup than UConn against the defending champion Stanford in the kickoff game Friday night.
Well, and I want to talk a little bit about how we got here. And one of the things that stood out to me in thinking about this is the situation that we were in last year. So I want to play a short clip. A player from the Oregon women's team, Sedona Prince, posting a video to TikTok comparing the tournament weight rooms between the men and the women. Here's an excerpt from that video.
So for the NCAA March Madness, the biggest tournament in college basketball for women, this is our weight room. Let me show y'all the men's weight room. Now, when pictures of our weight room got released versus the men's, the NCAA came out with a statement saying that it wasn't money, it was space that was a problem. Let me show y'all something else. Here's our practice court, right? And then here's that weight room. And then here's all this extra space. If you aren't upset about this problem, then you're a part of it.
Now, on the video, for the folks that remember, there were several seconds where Prince was just panning the phone camera around a men's gym full of weights and equipments as compared to the women's gym, which was just this small stack of hand weights and a few yoga mats. What impact do you think that video, Prince's video, had on this event?
Well, it was invaluable. And it was another data point in when you started out, Molly, by asking me, how did we get here? One of the things that I talk about in terms of how far we've come as we approach the second generation of post-Title IX is that unlike I was a young tomboy who grew up in central Illinois in the 50s and 60s, where there were no sports for me. And what Title IX did was change the calculation totally, so that young women today, for the first time in our history, grow up with a sense of entitlement to sports. They're not just happy to be there. They are outraged when they see that they are being treated differently. And that data point, which frankly shamed, which is really hard to do, some of your listeners may know, it's really hard to shame and embarrass the NCAA. There was such a backlash to the unequal treatment that the situation was immediately resolved, and the NCAA has fallen all over itself, letting everybody know as we approach this year's March Madness that everything is equal, equal, equal. It's really similar to what happened with Megan Rapinoe and the Women's World Cup soccer team.
Yes.
When they were used the World Cup soccer games as a way to argue for pay equity and bring that issue to the fore, because women today, as I said, feel a sense of entitlement, and that has never happened, and it wouldn't have happened without Title IX.
But are things equal today?
No. In a word, no. But you always, when I'm asked that question, Molly, what I think about is, well, what is our baseline of comparison? And this is not to say that women should not continue to push for equality any more than people shouldn't continue to push for any kind of equality, racial equality, social justice in all realms. But if your baseline of comparison is where we were before Title IX, our cup runneth over. Because as I said, for young girls like me, there were no teams, let alone scholarships. And today, it wouldn't occur to any young girl, and many of the women that I taught as Division I athletes at the University of Minnesota, it would never occur to them that if they wanted to play and they were good enough and they were willing to pay the price, that an opportunity would not be there. So that's been resolved. That's sort of settled law, if you will. But no, women still don't get anywhere near the treatment, the media coverage, and the money that the men do. But that's changing with each generation.
What do you see as the next frontier? I mean, as you mentioned, the law may be there, but the resources don't necessarily follow. And these are still issues that are litigated over. I mean, as you mentioned, the U.S. Women's soccer team suing over. So what's the next frontier here?
I think the next big frontier will be the issues around trans athletes and how that's going to play out. And I was talking to Tim, your producer, before I came on, and he just told me that the state legislature in Utah overrode the governor's veto of the trans law that will ban trans athletes from participating throughout the state. And the very first thing that I said to him was, and I presume that a lawsuit will soon follow. So I think that we're going to have a lot of that happening. And, you know, again, this is going to be a brave new world. It is a little bit ironic, Molly, as I've thought about this issue quite a bit over the last few weeks, especially with Leah Thompson, the trans woman swimmer being in the news who swims for Penn. You know, the whole point of Title IX was to increase opportunities for women. And now I think we're going to have a bunch of lawsuits trying to actually prevent trans women from participating with women. So that seems to be quite an ironic twist, and certainly something that lawmakers in 1972 could never have envisioned. But I think that's the next sort of brave new world, if you will, where we're going.
So how do you see Title IX being used in these lawsuits?
Well, the whole point, and again, I want to just stress that I'm not a lawyer or a legal scholar, but as I'm seeing this play out and people sort of jockeying for positions, on the one hand, you have trans athletes and their advocates saying, this is all about equity, and I should have the right and the opportunity to participate because sports is all about inclusion. And then you have the other side with, again, to me, ironically, women athletes saying, no, we want to, not all women athletes, I want to be really clear about that, but certainly a sizable number of female athletes and their advocates who are now starting to talk about lawsuits to try to ban trans women from participating. I think it's going to get played out in the courts. It's certainly going to get played out in the various voices that are, frankly, taking up sides. And I don't have any idea where this is headed. Maybe some of your listeners do.
Well, and we hope to hear from them. We're talking with Mary Jo Kane, Professor Emerita at the School of Kinesiology, the University of Minnesota, talking about the Title IX impacts on the weekend's Final Four of the NCAA Women's Basketball Championship Tournament. We want to hear what you think. 1-800-642-1234. Did you participate in women's sports at any level? What was your experience like? Did you give much thought to Title IX? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stenson for Rob Ferret. We're speaking with Title IX expert Mary Jo Kane, Professor Emerita at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about the history, the impact, the future of Title IX and women's sports. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Well, Mary Jo, you were starting to unpack the issue of transgender athletes and fairness in competition. You mentioned you're not a lawyer. I understand that, but how do you see this conversation playing out? As we've seen, you know, legislatures across the country putting forth legislation to try to curtail opportunities or restrict athletes from participating. What are you looking at when you watch these debates?
Well, I'm watching what the various constituencies and advocacy groups, including women athletes, are talking about. At the risk of being a little political here, you're right to say that a number of states are now taking up legislation. I think there's going to be a strong correlation between the states that do that and how conservative and, frankly, Republican-controlled states those are. One fear that I have is that trans athletes and this whole issue will become a cudgel for the right to, frankly, try to make trans athletes the boogeymen and women that they are not, even though I do think that there are very legitimate, personally think, there are very legitimate questions about fairness and equity. We are in, as I said, a brave new world. The science is by no means set. And I think that the sort of key takeaway for me is what we're trying to do here, Molly, is really find the sweet spot, if you will, between two very important competing interests. On the one hand, and nobody knows this more than those who care about women's sports, we want to be inclusive and diverse and have sports be a playground, if you will, for opportunity, not just about sports, but what sports can do for you. On the other hand, sports, especially at elite levels, is all about fairness in competition. And if one person is seen to have a competitive advantage biologically or physiologically, then is that fair? And that's where the rubber will hit the road here in terms of how this will ultimately be decided. And I quite frankly think it might even be decided at the federal level. Mm-hmm. Because the stakes are so high, and to have a uniform standard of participation. Mm-hmm. But if anybody says they know where this going, they know where this is going, I think they're being disingenuous because, as I said before, we are in a brave new world that nobody anticipated.
It's moving fast.
Yes, very fast.
So I want to go to the phones. We've got calls coming in for you, and I want to go first to Shauna, where we've got Maddie on the line. Good afternoon.
Hi. Glad you could take my call.
What's on your mind?
I guess I would have to say that God bless Title IX should probably be on an epitaph for many of the people who went through that era. I went to high school where there were no women's sports. There was something called GAA, Girls Athletic Association. And we would have such an exciting Saturday if we had a play day at one of the colleges. So then I went to college, and I thought I'd died and gone to heaven because it was women's sports. I took the job in Shawano in 1965, We had no women's, 1969, we had no women's sports, and it was like pulling teeth to get that to happen, and it did gradually. Eventually, I think one of the big turnarounds was in 1973, 74, our volleyball team won the very first state championship of Wisconsin. Wow. And when we were coming back to Sano, except for the parents, there were no cars in the parking lot or anything like that.
Yeah.
In 1988, we were fortunate enough to win it again. And the amount of support had changed drastically. A 47-car caravan from Bondwell. The parking lot was full. The gym was full. We had gained a tremendous amount of respect and reputation.
Maddie, thank you. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. And, you know, I imagine, Mary Jo Kane, that you have heard so many stories like this from women across the country throughout your work.
Oh, forever and ever and ever. And I just as Maddie began her comment with God bless Title IX, I would like to say God bless Maddie and all of the women who came before. You could just hear the excitement in her voice because it shows so many women who wanted to play sports, who love sports, and who care deeply about sports. And the great thing about Title IX, Molly, is that after, again, decades of being told that girls didn't want to play sports, and even if they did, they wouldn't be any good, the thing that was great about Title IX is that we built them ballparks and playing fields all over this country, and sometimes women like Maddie had to, like, break the doors down. But we're here. We're in unprecedented numbers, and I would urge Maddie and anybody else who wants to drive over to Twin Cities this weekend, it's a sellout, but maybe you can get a ticket on the street. But there is enormous interest, and as I said, God bless Maddie and all those people in Wisconsin who paved the way for all of us.
Well, I want to go back to the phones now. We've got Elizabeth joining us from Madison. Good afternoon.
Hi, Molly. First-time caller, long-time listener, and I grew up with Title IX, so I'm really grateful to Mary Jo and all the women who fought for this, and I love sports. I'm calling because I want to know who you're picking to win the Final Four, Mary Jo. And are you excited about Don Staley?
Oh, my God. Don, you want to talk about a legend. Elizabeth, if you don't mind, I probably should take the fifth on who I think will win. But I don't know. Did you watch the game last night between the University of Connecticut and NC State that went into double overtime? I mean, I don't know. Here's what
amazing.
I think. Say it again.
It was amazing.
And Paige Beckers, yeah. Sorry to be a homer here, Elizabeth, but Paige Beckers is from right outside the Twin Cities. So if you're a fan of women's sports and women's basketball in particular, Elizabeth, who you clearly are, you could not ask for a better lineup. I mean, think about this. Tara Vanderveer and the defending champions Stanford against Gino Auriemma and Paige Beckers. And then speaking of Dawn Staley, right? Iconic coach who brought South Carolina out of nowhere. And then Louisville, who's been there. I don't know. But Elizabeth, at the risk of being, I don't know, who are you picking? Come on.
It's hard because I like a dynasty, but I also like the underdog.
Yep.
Which leaves you with what, Louisville? So, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where I don't care who wins because there is just such joy watching people play.
Yes. Joy is absolutely right. And you are talking about some enormously talented women and coaches and legends and traditions. And again, we would not be here without Title IX. And I couldn't be more proud and lucky and filled with gratitude that the Final Four is here this weekend.
And I want to squeak in one last call. We've got Becky on the line from Beaver Dam. Becky, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, what's on your mind?
Well, hey, I just wanted to give a little bit of feedback also on Title IX and how important that is to me, I guess. And having grown up, hearing I was involved in sports and a lot of basketball, volleyball, softball, and track and such. But my mom would talk often about having – she played basketball when she was growing up and would talk about how, you know, the girls could only run half court because they weren't – they didn't feel that girls could run full court at that time. And so it just really – it kind of always stuck in my mind how I appreciated the opportunities that I had. And I thought my high school coach did a great job where, in high school, he brought in graduated players and would
Becky,
talk to them. And
I so hate to do this, but we are up against the clock, and I want to get Mary Jo to respond to you. So, Mary Jo, we've just got a minute left.
Yeah, and I'll try to be obviously brief. But, Becky, again, I want to thank you and for talking about your mother and for all of the ways in which Title IX has made such a difference over the generations, Molly. And as I am asked, as I often am, as we approach the 50th anniversary of Title IX, and I am sure this is true about the great state of Wisconsin and the women who have called in have made that clear. And this is what the impact of Title IX has really been. And that is, in two generations, we've gone from young girls like me and Maddie and Elizabeth all over this country hoping that there is a team to young girls all over this country today hoping that they make the team. And that's the difference because of Title IX.
Thank you, Mary Jo Kane. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. And again, thank you for inviting me, and go Final Four.
Mary Jo Kane, Professor Emerita at the School of Kinesiology at the University of Minnesota. We were speaking about the legacy of Title IX and women's sports today. Coming up after the news, spending on lobbying broke records last year. We'll talk about what that money was spent on and why we don't hear as much about lobbying reform efforts anymore. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we bring you up to date on the Ukraine-Russia war. But first, last year was a record-breaking year for the lobbying industry. Businesses and interest groups spent $3.7 billion, more than any other year on record. And that was as lawmakers in Congress passed legislation to help the economy recover from the pandemic. And President Joe Biden tried, with mixed results, to pass his economic agenda. Now, reforms to the lobbying industry have fallen out of headlines in recent years. We want to talk about why and where those reform efforts stand today. And we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about the effects of lobbying on our government? Do you think it's important for businesses, unions, other groups to have a voice in politics? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page as well. Jim Thurber is our guest. He's a distinguished professor with American University's Department of Government. He's also the founder of the Public Affairs and Advocacy Institute at American University, where he teaches lobbying and ethics. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
First off, why do you think we saw so much spending on lobbying last year?
Well, lobbying usually goes up when there's a great deal of legislative activity and regulatory activity, which was going on last year. When we have a new president that came in and pushed through the COVID recovery bill, the infrastructure bill, and tried to push through Build Back Better, which had tax and spending provisions, everyone got focused and they started spending more money. The money came primarily from business, not reform groups, obviously. And it came from, you know, the big spender was the U.S. Chamber of Commerce with $66 million spent 1 year, and then the National Association of Realtors. But pharma and pharmaceutical companies, but also healthcare companies, were very involved because of a variety of issues like the pandemic and the regulations associated with vaccinations and masking and those things, they got involved. But Meta and Amazon and other high-tech IT companies were involved because they're getting pushback on privacy, pushback on buying smaller firms and becoming monopolies. So it was a active year. But to put it in perspective, the average amount of money being spent is about $3.5 billion. It shot up to $3.73 billion. Let me just say that this is just the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole lot of activity in Washington that most people would say is lobbying, but it's not covered under the Lobby Disclosure Act or the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And so I would double 3.7 as to the amount spent last year.
So what impact do you think this has on our government?
Well, we have First Amendment rights. We allow people to organize and petition government to lobby. And everybody can do it, but it leans towards organizations that have resources, money. Doesn't mean that money buys influence, but it certainly buys access. And so it brings forward problems and solutions in government that are leaning towards those who have enough money to tell people about it. And so it really alienates a whole lot of people because they think government is bought, sold, and rented by specialized interests. It isn't. It's competitive. And yet we need, I think, to have reforms that enforce existing law, but also bring more transparency to what's going on. The bottom line is democracy is very fragile, as we've seen this year with respect to Trump's accusation that the election was stolen in January 6th, and just part of that whole picture of people who are sort of alienated towards government because they think it's all specialized interests doing this. I think we need more transparency. I'm a reformer. We need more transparency and more enforcement of existing law with respect to lobbying.
So how do you think about the last administration where there was this call to you know, so-called drain the swamp, you know, speaking to people feeling that government had been corrupted? What impact has that had?
Well, drain the swamp came about in about 2005. It was an expression by Pelosi. Major reforms went through. I helped work on them in 2007, implemented in 2008. And it was stated by Obama, who was one of the reformers while he was a senator, and then Trump pushed it also. He had a whole series of reforms that he proposed. None of them were implemented, and in fact, there was an open revolving door from specialized interests to run the agencies that were related to those industries. There are 88 lobbyists that one day they were lobbyists, the next day they ran an agency. It became worse. The swamp had more creatures. They didn't drain it at all. Biden has been very quiet about that. He goes along with the reforms that Obama had, and he'd like to clean it up, but he has not made it as a primary focus of his administration. Too many other problems with the pandemic, the war, inflation, and a variety of other issues.
Sure. So with this, you know, as you mentioned, more money, big ticket legislation at stake, you know, attracts more interest, attracts more money into lobbying. I mean, can you pinpoint an exact impact, like a corrosive impact on our government by that increase in spending?
Well, that's a great question. Political scientists struggle with trying to define impact. I won't get into all the methodology of it, but let me say that I think the ultimate impact is that people don't trust government when they think that it's that big money buys access and influence. What big money does is it slows things down. It stops things. There's huge numbers of lobbyists against Build Back Better because it had to do with taxes as well as spending. And you don't see it, but it's there. And it's easy to stop things, very hard to push things. And so I think Americans see their problems in their lives and they'd like to see some progress. And they see a Congress that's gridlocked, tied in the Senate, almost tied in the House, and with lobbyists having too much influence. And so I think that's bad for our democracy. The outcome of all of this is bad for our democracy. Now, on the other side, we need to have information and knowledge from those outside of government that are affected by the laws that are being considered. And so, therefore, we need lobbyists, but we need them, you know, environmentalists as well as pro-industry types. We need more competition among the various interests, and we don't have it sometimes. Sometimes it's quite lopsided, and certain areas are captured by certain industries, and they have the say, and others don't.
We're speaking with Jim Thurber, professor at American University, where he studies lobbying and political influence. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz, in for Rob Ferret. We're talking today about lobbying, its effect on our government, and efforts to reform the industry. We're speaking with Jim Thurber, professor at American University, and we want to hear your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. Should there be stricter rules to limit the power of lobbyists and special interests they represent? Give us a call or give us a comment on our Ideas Network Facebook page. So, Jim, this is your expertise. You study this impact. What do you think needs to be done with regard to lobbying to restore that faith and that trust in American government that you were talking about?
Well, I think the primary thing first and foremost is we don't need to pass new laws. We need to enforce the existing law of the Lobby Disclosure Act. There's lots of people in Washington who are lobbying who are not registered. Therefore, we don't know what they're doing. Now, it probably is okay what they're doing, but we need to know more about it. We need to have more transparency, and therefore we need to enforce and have people who are lobbying actually register. Secondly, we need better definitions in the Lobby Disclosure Act, which regulates the industry, about who they're lobbying, what they're lobbying on, and how much they're spending. It's pretty loose. And under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, for the first time in 50 years, we've had a couple of indictments and convictions of people lobbying for a foreign country without registering, which is the law since 1938, since we had Nazis lobbying to keep us out of the war. One of them was Manafort, who was lobbying for Ukraine and not lobbying. And there are others who were lobbying for Turkey and others. And we need to enforce that, have better definitions within the Foreign Agents Registration Act about lobbying. It's very broad. It's so broad that sometimes people ignore it. But once those indictments occurred, by the way, all of a sudden a whole bunch of people in Washington registered under the Foreign Agents Registration. It got their attention. And now we know more. Over 800 new people registered under this act, and we know more about it. I think that scandal drives reform, and we have scandal up on the Hill right now with respect to members trading stock. We have a thing called the Stock Act that regulates that. But a couple members in Georgia from the Senate lost their race to a certain extent. It was so close. You could point to this by buying and selling stock when they knew about the pandemic. They had information before other people about the pandemic. We need to stop that. We need to have, and this is a proposal that's moving, have everybody, senior staff as well as members in the House and the Senate, put their investments in a trust fund, because there's a huge conflict of interest there. That's part of lobbying also. But the main thing I would do, although I'm in the reform area and I have a whole list of things that should be done that probably won't be done, I would enforce existing law. By the way, there was a major proposal called H.R. 1 that's referred to the first bill out of the House this Congress and the last Congress to bring about reforms on lobbying, but also reforms on the administration of elections to improve access to elections and ensure security, and also on redistricting, have commissions do it, have better oversight over ethics in the executive branch and other things. It passed overwhelmingly in the House, and the minority leader, Mitch McConnell, said, we will not take up anything in H.R. 1. And since the Senate is tied, it's very easy to stop legislation, and so nothing has started. So the Democrats are associated with reform. Doesn't mean all of them are for it. And the Republicans seem to be dragging their feet with respect to reform for lobbying and ethics.
We're speaking with Jim Thurber from American University, and we do have a caller for you, Jim. Let's go to the phones. We've got Nate in Milwaukee joining us. Good afternoon.
Hi, thank you. I'll try to quickly run through a few points for you. First, that historically it was arguably activist conservative judges that kept stripping away some of the rules about money in politics over the years. Also, a number of referendums have passed, including in Wisconsin, that were for campaign finance reform, and including some specifically stating that money should not be treated as speech. And just because it came up, I would argue that Manafort was not advocating for Ukraine, but rather a corrupt pro-Putin former Ukrainian politician, which is a noteworthy point because of current events.
So those are two good points. The second one I agree with. It actually was very technical. It was lobbying for a think tank that was associated with the past pro-Putin president. With respect to campaign finance, that's a whole area that needs reform. The Supreme Court allowed corporations and other organizations, unions, to use money as speech, and we don't know where the money is coming from into these super PACs. We don't know where it's going until 6 months after it's been done. It really has undermined transparency about campaign finance in elections, but it also undermines our trust in the whole system. I would reform that. Also, I agree with Nate, and thank you for calling.
And Jim, something you said earlier about Congress and lawmakers putting their investments in a trust fund. I'm very curious. We just have a few moments left, but I'm very curious how that would work in practice. Is there legislation currently to this effect?
There is legislation pending. It is not required now. I'm just advocating that they do it. Senator Ted Kennedy always put his portfolio in a blind trust. It can be done. It's easy. Carter, when he was president, put his investments in a blind trust. He actually sold his peanut farm so that there would not be a conflict of interest between what he was doing and peanut farmers in America. It's possible, and in fact, there's some bipartisan support for that reform. And as I started out with the hypothesis that scandal drives reform, well, there's been some scandal, a significant scandal about trades on inside information, not covered by the SEC, but on the Hill, and that both Democrats and Republicans would like to see that regulated. They differ on the details. And one of the proposals that seems to be moving, it is not law now, is to force everyone to have their investments in a blind trust.
So in the last minute we have, what are you watching most closely on Capitol Hill?
Well, right now I'm writing and watching about the Foreign Agents Registration Act, and it's niche, but I'm also looking at how Russia and China use our Foreign Agents Registration Act to throw pro-democracy groups out of their country. They use the actual language from our act to do that. I'm also looking at the implementation of the Lobby Disclosure Act. That's the major regulation over lobbyists in the United States, and I would like to see it spread to people who are obviously lobbying, like strategic advisors and coalition builders and social media people that are in these campaigns. We don't know how much money is being spent in those areas. It's not covered by the act. I'd like to see it covered by the act.
We will certainly follow up with you on that and keep us posted. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Jim Thurber, an expert on lobbying and special interests, political influence. He is a professor at American University. The COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated long-term college enrollment declines as well as worker shortages in Wisconsin. As higher education and industry adapt, they're redefining the traditional pipeline from high school. Rich Kramer reports.
On a Friday afternoon, Random Lake High School's gymnasium is full of students moving through a sea of folding tables. More than 50 employers from industries like manufacturing, healthcare, and hospitality are there to talk about their post-graduation options. Dominic Montello is checking out employers. After making good money at a summer job, taking on debt for college doesn't sound that appealing.
I want to get right into the workforce, make money, as much money as I can.
Kelly Weibelhaus is manning a table for Career Foods, which manufactures popular soda and energy drink brands. She says the company is looking for students just like Dominic to go through the co-op course they developed with the high school. It offers paid, part-time work for seniors that can lead to a post-graduation job.
So why not put them in the workforce, see what they like, and then if they like that, have a company pay for their college.
Career Foods, like many companies, offers tuition reimbursement as part of its benefits package. The pandemic and low unemployment rates have added to long-term enrollment declines at two-year campuses in the state. Over the past decade, enrollment has fallen by 34% at state technical colleges and nearly 57% at two-year University of Wisconsin system campuses. Random Lake District Administrator Michael Trimberger is a co-founder of the nonprofit Inspire Sheboygan County, which acts as a bridge between businesses and regional high schools developing work-based curriculum. He says exposing kids to jobs before graduation makes more sense than having them choose a path while taking on student loan debt.
As we deconstruct the old narrative, the new narrative should be figure out what you want to do, explore what you want to do, and when you know, then skill yourself up through education and get to the level that you want to be able to really define what your success is.
Colleges and universities have long been partnering with high schools. The number of kids taking dual enrollment courses where students work toward associate's degrees has skyrocketed in recent years. At the same time, the percentage of high school grads, particularly young men, going straight to college is declining. Recent Plymouth High School graduate A.J. Klug says he felt lost near the end of his high school career. He thought about college but was deterred by the prospect of taking on lots of student loan debt. Instead, he signed up for an 80-hour co-op with local car dealership Van Horn Automotive and felt at home working alongside master mechanics.
And I got into the shop and I said to myself, this is actually something that I enjoy doing. You know, I found something. I don't have to, you know, worry about it so much anymore.
Klug is still working for the dealership and taking tech college classes toward a certification. Van Horn offered an apprenticeship program with $6,500 in scholarships for tools and tuition. Klug expects to finish his certificate without any debt. As businesses make inroads to high schools, the traditional pipeline from high school to college is changing. Wisconsin Technical College President Morna Foy says flexibility is more important than ever.
I think the career pathway, this idea that there are many entry and exit points, is really a reflection on the most significant change in higher ed. It is now being driven by what students and employers through their employees need.
Projections show the number of people hitting retirement age in many states will quickly outpace the number of working age adults. What's been dubbed the silver tsunami is likely to drive more high school recruitment by businesses and even greater changes for colleges. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we take a look at the latest developments in the war between Russia and Ukraine. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time, here on the Ideas Network.